chef gets good at cooking from repetition. Well, so does a home cook. A serious home cook makes recipes over and over again and perfects them. That's really no different than a professional chef.
Welcome to Homemade. I'm Marty Duncan. This is another really special episode for me. I have been a fan of hers since the early days of Food Network, and I'm just so honored to welcome Sarah Moulton to the show today. Back in the 90s, she was one of Food Network's first breakout stars. She took what she learned from working with Julia Child and brought it directly into our kitchens. Her show, Cooking Live, taught millions of us how to cook.
So here goes our marinade over the warm artichokes. Oh boy, that looks good. And I've got a call from Susan. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Sarah.
I'm going to go down here and fluff up my couscous while we talk.
Okay.
Okay.
She has been a staple on our televisions for over 40 years now, and her current show, Sarah's Weeknight Meals, airs on your local PBS station. Her latest book is called Home Cooking 101, How to Make Everything Taste Better, and we're going to learn how to do just that today. Sarah, welcome to Homemade.
Thanks, Marty. So happy to be here.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you. I've been a big fan for a long time. I think the reason is I'm a home cook. I have never been to culinary school. And for people like me, whether we make our living in food or not, you've made being a home cook kind of a cool thing. I love your latest cookbook. I think that one is a really good tool for people. Home Cooking 101, is that your favorite of all your cookbooks that you have?
Well, you know how they say it's like making you pick a child, a favorite child. But I would say that it's really the compilation of my 40 years and everything I've learned along the way, you know, both being a professional chef, but also doing TV for the home cook and learning from home cooks.
That's right, because you encourage questions from your readers and your viewers. They write in and you address those questions and answer them on your show.
Yes, we do. And it's what I did on when I was on the Food Network, my first show, Cooking Live, as you mentioned, that live show. That was 6 years, 1,200 shows every night. And I got really used to talking to people around the country and also got very impressed by home cooks. I was like, whoa, these people are serious. You know, when you think about it, a chef gets good at cooking from repetition. Well, so does a home cook. You know, a serious home cook makes recipes over and over again and perfects them. That's really no different than a professional chef.
Very true. Congratulations on season 10 of Sarah's Weeknight Meals. That's a wonderful show on PBS, and y'all can catch it on YouTube and other places if you don't have access to a PBS station. But it's wonderful because I like the part where you travel around the country and you see different parts of the country, and then you make these wonderful dishes. Is there somewhere you haven't been? It seems like in 10 seasons, you've been just about everywhere, but is there somewhere you haven't been?
Oh, no, there's plenty of states we haven't been. I'll be brutally honest. Oftentimes we go to a state because it's related to one of our sponsors. So, you know, that's how we end up in Louisiana or Arkansas, which was really fun. But no, I'd like to go to all the states because, again, back to when I did my live show on the Food Network, I discovered all the cool sort of regional cuisine. Every part of the country has their local favorites and their unusual dishes, which nobody anywhere else would make. And everybody's weeknight meal is different. There's no one standard. And a lot of us also, of course, are descendants of immigrants. So it's influenced by, say, in Minnesota, it would be Scandinavian. In other parts of the country, it might be Polish or Russian. So it's fun to see how that's seeped into the home cook's repertoire.
I want to reflect on a quote that I read from you. Behind every chef is a mother, an aunt, a grandmother. And I think that's so true, don't you? There's some home cook inspiring all these wonderful, big-time, notable chefs, like Marcus Samuelson, for example. We just did an episode on grandmothers, and I would encourage you to listen to it because it's really charming. But Marcus told a wonderful story about his grandmother. So how was it growing up in your home? Did your mom cook? I know she was a big influence on you with her dinner parties.
Yes. Well, you know, it's funny you should bring that up. And first of all, Marcus Samuelson is a sweetie pie. Don't we adore him?
So much.
He lights up every room he walks into. But back to my grandmother. Her name was Ruth Moulton. We named my daughter after her. My daughter's name is Ruthie. And Ruth Moulton actually went to the Garland Cooking School in Boston.
Your grandmother?
My grandmother did.
Wow!
Not to be a professional chef, just to be a better home cook. And she was one heck of a really good home cook and a great baker. So like many other people, including, say, Gail Gand, who's a pastry chef from Chicago, my first cookbook was Mud Pies and Other Recipes, you know, which was just fun. But then I got to bake with my grandmother. And because I was a little butterball and I loved my sweets and I loved my carbs, that was a lot of fun. And then growing up in New York City, when I was in high school, my mom, actually, even before then, was a fantastic cook and completely self-taught. In the 50s and the 60s, when other women were feeling liberated to throw a TV dinner into the oven, my mom was cooking from scratch and working with such exotic ingredients at the time as endive and fresh fennel and sauteing shad roe and stuffing mushrooms and doing all these things, and then throwing dinner parties. And after she started traveling to Europe, we had to eat the food of the place she'd just been. And we had the New York Times cookbook by Craig Claiborne, which was our Bible. And I found out it is a Bible for a lot of other professional chefs, because that's where you could find all these international recipes in one big book. And I became her sous chef. And so that's, yes, absolutely how I got trained. To begin with.
But then your mom was so smart. She blindly wrote letters to both Julia Child and Craig Claiborne asking, what should my daughter do if she wants to pursue a career in food? And he responded.
Yes, he did. I think my mom's letter to Julia must have gotten lost because Julia answered every single letter. But yeah, Craig wrote back and said I should go to cooking school if I wanted to become a chef. My mom really did call my bluff. Yes.
And so you went on to the CIA, Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, became a professional chef. So how did you make it? Because your first TV experience was with Julia.
Yes.
How did you make it there? I mean, how does that even happen?
Well, you know, I've had lots of good luck in my life, right place, right time kind of thing. I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1978. And in 78, I was the chef manager of a catering operation in Cambridge. And I hated catering, but it was a stepping stone to a restaurant job. And we were peeling a million hard-boiled eggs, me and one of my workers. And we started talking about Julia, because Julia didn't boil her eggs. She had this whole method, which is much better than boiling eggs, to get hard-cooked eggs. And this young lady said, oh, you know, I'm a volunteer on her show. I was like, really? And so I said, do you think Julia could take another volunteer? And she said, well, yeah, let me ask her. And so she came in the next day and said, I told Julia all about you and she wants to hire you.
Wow.
So I went down to the corner payphone, called up Julia. Julia got right on the phone. She was listed. And the first question she asked me was, oh, dearie, do you food style? I'd never done it professionally in 1978. You don't get the training you do now. So I thought real long and hard, and I lied. And I said, yes, I was really good. So I got the job. Sometimes I tell that story to young people who I might be mentoring, that sometimes you have to take a leap. You have to, you know, do that.
Yes. Have you done that? Oh, yes. Lots of times. And then figure it out. Yeah. You'll get it.
Yes.
What was the secret to the eggs? She didn't boil them. Did she bake them?
No. And by the way, I've now got yet another way to do eggs. But the way Julia did it was she'd put her eggs in cold. Oh, she did weird things too, like Julia always did. She would prick them with a little pin so that they didn't expect. I don't remember quite what the logic was, but the important part, the real nugget, was she'd put the eggs in cold water, bring them up to a boil, take them off the heat and cover them and give them, say, 14 minutes without the boiling, and then immediately drain them and put them in the ice water. Now, what this did is if you don't boil them, the whites are much more tender. And if you get them right into ice water, you cool them down very fast. You don't get that green line between the yolk and the white. So the new way that I do it is to steam them. I learned this from a couple in Chicago, and now I think it's become pretty common knowledge. So I take one of those hippie steamers, I call them hippie steamers, the ones that sort of fold out, and you put water below, just below the steamer. You put the eggs in cold water, bring the steamer up to a simmer or a hard boil, but then turn it down to a simmer and covered 12 minutes and then right into ice water. Now, one would think that a steamer was too violent and that the whites would be really, really tough, but they are even more tender than Julia's method.
Wow.
And I find the eggs much easier to peel, whether they're fresh or not fresh. So there you go. Keeps evolving.
Yeah, it does. And every year it seems like there's a new way to do it. I've changed mine over the last 10 years. I think I probably changed mine two or three times and always seem to be better until you get the next one.
I know. And then what were you thinking? Yeah. Why were you doing it that other way?
Yeah. So speaking of Julia and your experience with her, is there a favorite story?
Oh, gosh. Well, let me just say a couple things. First of all, she was one of the funniest people I ever met, hands down. Really, sincerely funny. Because she was so smart and so refreshingly honest, she would just call it for what it was. And she would take you off guard. She was hysterical. Two things. One is that she wasn't pretentious, even though one would think she was, because she made all these fancy dishes. You know, you'd watch her and she'd do all this elaborate stuff and then tell you how easy it was. And it didn't look remotely easy.
Right.
And I love that about her. But she threw dinner parties. We would go over to her house and cook together. And in the middle of the whole thing, she would say, "Aren't we having so much fun?" But if she didn't feel like making a fancy hors d'oeuvre, she always had a stash of Pepperidge Farm goldfish in the cupboard. And that's what she would serve. And she sincerely loved them. The other thing at dinner parties was at the end when we were all done and everybody was finished with their dessert, she'd have us all retire to the living room and she'd show that Dan Aykroyd Saturday Night Live parody of herself. She loved it.
Oh, that's hysterical. I didn't know she'd ever seen it. Oh, I love that. So I'm going to close my eyes and I want you to tell me what it's like being a guest at Julia's house for a dinner party. I mean, let's just assume you weren't helping to cook or in the kitchen part of the time. You were just there, fly on the wall. What would it be like?
You would arrive and Paul Child would get you some sort of wonderful drink or perhaps a bit of champagne, chilled champagne. And then if we had made hors d'oeuvres, that would be passed. And everybody would hang out in the kitchen for a while because that was the place. And then the table, we would have set the table beautifully with napkins and flatware and glasses and flowers. And then we'd sit down and have a fantastic conversation, you know. Or in the summer, she had a little teeny weeny backyard. In recent history, my dad, who just passed away 2 years ago, lived in Cambridge. And I would walk around when I was visiting, because I think Cambridge is so pretty. And I made a point of going back to her house. And it was so much smaller than I remembered it. It was tall, but in terms of the front lawn and back lawn, I thought they were, you know, tremendous, and they weren't. I mean, I didn't exactly snoop around in the back, but from where I was, I could see that it was pretty small. But sometimes we go back and have an aperitif in the backyard, so that was fun too. But it was very convivial. I mean, the thing that Julia understood, besides teaching people about how to make French cuisine, is how to enjoy life and culture the way the French did and how to dine.
Right.
It's not just about feeding yourself. It's about everything else that goes with it.
Sounds like for these kinds of events that she would try to keep it a little bit more simple, probably so she could have some fun at her own party.
Right. I mean, one of the things about Julia that was amazing is because, of course, everybody wanted to talk to her about food 24/7. And I'm sure most of us wanted to impress her with our deep knowledge and how cool we were in the culinary department. But really, she got tired of that. She wanted to talk about movies. She wanted to talk about culture. She wanted to talk about politics. She was a very lively individual.
Well, I feel like there must have been a couple of really great tips that she gave you early on those first weeks that you were there. Can you recall like something that she taught you that has stuck with you that you continue to teach now?
Oh my God, there are so many. I will say one of the biggest ones, and it's the one that I taught Rachel Ray, and Rachel would agree, which is that when you do TV, you must smile.
True, true, true.
Nobody even needs to explain the reason, but if you think about it, when you smile, it's sort of like you're selling your point that much better. You know, it's like, yes, you too should make coq-au-vin, you know?
Yes, and it's easy because I'm smiling.
Yes, and you must believe me. So I would say that's the biggie, but there were many others. As a home cook, and this is one I try to share with everybody, is never apologize, never explain. So when you have people over for dinner, don't tell them everything you did wrong. They're so glad that you made dinner and they didn't. So don't ruin it for them by saying, oh, it needed more salt. I should have reduced it. I should have added acid. You know, don't do that.
Yes, I have the worst habit of doing that.
We all do. Me too.
I am going to take that and put it in my pocket and keep it because I'm going to stop doing that.
We have one of those refrigerators you can't really put magnets on the front. We have a tiny little square on the side where you can put magnets. My niece had a magnet about this big made with Julia Child on it saying, never apologize, never explain. So it's right there anytime I'm making dinner for guests so I can try to control myself.
You're listening to Homemade. When we come back, Sarah tells me about how the challenges for home cooks have changed since her Food Network debut 25 years ago and how she turns leftover pork chops into yummy burger patties. We'll be right back after the break. Marty Duncan, and my guest today is chef, author, and TV personality Sarah Moulton. Sarah, you were one of the earliest breakout stars on Food Network. I can't even imagine what that was like. You did thousands of episodes of TV, and you really are a teacher. But how has it changed from those early days of Food Network to the questions you get now? How the challenges for home cooks changed since you began on TV all those years ago?
It's amazing how much it's changed. So I started April 2nd, 1996, doing Cooking Live. And it really was live. It wasn't live to tape. It wasn't a live audience. It was live, live. People would call in and with, you know, all of these questions. But what was fun for me and what made it easy for me to do is they didn't know much. So back then, you know, panko breadcrumbs were revolutionary. Chipotles in adobo. Oh my goodness.
Never heard of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So there was, we would introduce, or, you know, one of those curved fish spatulas, which sort of changed my life. It was like, oh, wow, this is so cool. So we could look so terribly wise because I worked at Gourmet Magazine during the day and because my team at Food Network. So we would have all this wisdom to share with them. Now, and I experience it most when I'm doing cooking demos, live cooking demos, I can't get away with that stuff. I practically have to stand on my head to get a rise out of anybody because they know everything now.
Yes, the audience knows everything and they see all your mistakes, especially in those live demos. Weren't you going to put the flour in there? Oh, yes,
yes.
You're absolutely right. I was going to put the flour in there.
Right. So I can't sort of impress them anymore because they are very impressive. And I would say the last year of being locked in has made people even better cooks. People who've never cooked are cooking, but people who sort of did cook have been cooking a lot more and getting better, you know, including in baking. Oh my God, this whole sourdough business, you know, is off the charts.
Yeah, you couldn't get yeast, could you?
No.
I made one of Jacques Pepin does his videos, you know, and I'm addicted to them. I watch them every day. He's just so adorable and charming. And I know you have your Julia history together, but he did a no knead bread. And I'm like, well, I'm going to try that. And it was so good.
Wasn't that exciting?
Yeah, yes. It was just so good. But yes, I think everybody, even people who didn't intend to bake are now bakers. But I think people have gotten a bit fatigued, don't you think? How can we overcome that kitchen fatigue, and how can we be re-energized toward our cooking right now?
You know what? This has happened to me. It doesn't even matter about the pandemic. Throughout my career, and I'm a professional chef, that I get really bored with my own cooking. And what I generally do in a situation like that is I go get a new cookbook with a new cuisine that I'm not that familiar with. And then I get in all the spices and ingredients, and I just try to cook my way through it. So that's what I would do. So the equivalent for me right now is for Christmas, I got one of those Instapot things because I was like, I really need to know about this. And then I've got a couple of different cookbooks that I've been cooking my way through. Jury's still out whether I think it's a worthwhile tool. I have to be honest. I do like making an amazing stew that quickly. But that's what I've been doing to sort of entertain myself, taking on a new tool. You can do a new tool or a new cuisine. And I think that's what everybody needs to do. I will say that throughout this pandemic, and also for the prior 2 years when my mom had died in 2013, and my dad was great till the end. He died in July of 2019, even went on a fishing trip the week before he died. He was 94. He kept saying he was 95, but he wasn't. But at any rate, after he died, going through that sadness and then, you know, moving into the coronavirus after that, I have to say the highlight of every day was dinner. It's very important, I think, to still make a really nice dinner and sit down and enjoy it and try a new wine. And, you know, that's another thing we've done. I mean, not expensive wines, just a new wine from a new country.
Any, yeah. Yes.
And just try to celebrate at the end of every day. It really, really kept us going. I mean, as sad as I was in 2019, there was always dinner.
Right.
You know, when we were up emptying out his house, it was the fall of 2019. So we could still get wonderful takeout food. And we celebrated every night. We ate oysters as much as we could because my dad loved oysters.
Oh, mine did too. I host a big oyster cook-off down in Gulf Shores, Alabama every year.
Wow.
And yes. And
good for
you. We have grown and grown and grown. It's 10 years and we had to cancel this past year for the first time. But boy, if you're an oyster lover, you're an oyster lover. I know Julia cooked. I was always surprised when she would break out and cook oysters. What's one of your favorite oyster recipes? I mean, you can't go wrong with a Rockefeller. Everybody likes that. But have you got an oyster recipe that's your go-to?
Well, here's the thing. I like Rockefeller for sure. I like them raw. Straight up. And my brother, who also lives in New York, but has a porch or a patio or whatever where he grows things, one of the things he grows is aji dulce. Do you know what those are?
No.
They're little chilies. They look like scotch bonnets. And they have the flavor of a scotch bonnet, but not the heat.
Okay.
So they're, you know how scotch bonnets and habaneros, which are vaguely related, are very sort of fruity, almost like a cross between a mango and a chili. They're very, very fruity. They have a wonderful flavor. Well, aji dulce has that sort of wonderful fruity flavor without too much heat. So my brother, who loves oysters also, started putting it into his mignonette.
Oh, nice.
So the mignonette is shallots, a little bit of sugar, white vinegar, and the chopped up aji dulce. And that is my idea of sheer bliss with oysters and beautiful oysters, of course, raw.
So what's weeknight dinner looking like at your house these days, for example? What are you making tonight?
Oh, it's so interesting. You should bring that up because I have belonged to a women's culinary group, the New York Women's Culinary Alliance. And one of our members, who's from the Caribbean, is also vegan and is doing a program about how vegan cooking is really important in Caribbean cuisine. And it's a cook-along.
Oh, fun.
So I bought all the ingredients, and I've already prepped them before you and I started talking today. And I'm going to do that tonight. But then, because I do have a bit of a meathead for a husband, I thought, well, I should probably have some protein on the side for him. We had some leftover pork chops. I love leftovers.
I do too.
So I took these cooked pork chops and I ground them up in the food processor and I added feta and fresh oregano and sauteed onions and garlic and an egg to bind and some breadcrumbs. And I'm going to shape them into patties and then put them again in breadcrumbs and saute them. I've done this with lamb chops before.
I was about to say that sounds good with lamb too.
Yeah, it was really good with lamb. So we're having, I'm not telling the ladies in my women's culinary group, but we're having a nice vegan Caribbean vegetable dish. And then I'm going to make these pork patties or pork burgers. And then we'll have a nice big salad.
Very nice. Sounds wonderful. What time am I coming over?
Anytime.
All right. So what are your two or three best tips for leftovers? That's a good one. Repurposing some already cooked pork chops. That's a great one. Give me two of your best tips for leftovers.
Well, you know, it's sort of like they tell me what to do. They really have their own life. But, you know, they often end up in soups. I love, love, love making soup. And so it's really, I just throw it all into a soup. Saute some onions, add some garlic. I almost always start that way. Maybe I'll add some tomatoes, but then everything else just goes in. And I always make to go with that. I always have some artisanal bread in the freezer. Usually I didn't make it. Occasionally it's my artisanal bread.
Right.
But I have already sliced bread, so I take it out and I make faux garlic bread. I pop it in the toaster, and then when it comes out, I rub it with really good olive oil, brush it with olive oil, and then rub it with a cut clove of garlic and sprinkle it with a little salt. And so my family is perfectly fine with having a hearty bowl of soup and that toast.
I am a big fan of, I mean, even in the summer, big bowl of soup. It's just comforting and feels good, and it's easy too.
Yes, it is. Particularly if you have leftovers.
Yeah, I grow butternut squash, so I make that a lot, and I never get tired of it.
Oh, nice.
All right, so I'm going to put you on the spot. You have met everybody. You know everybody. If you were to sit down and watch a cooking program, who would you watch? It can be old or new. Doesn't have to be on TV now.
Obviously, Jacques and Julia. I mean, Jacques is another hero of mine. And I've learned so much from him. Back to our hard-boiled egg conversation. Every time for years I saw him, he'd show me a new way to mince garlic. And I'd still be mincing garlic the last way he showed me, thinking it was the best way. So I guess Jacques, because nobody knows as much as he does, and nobody's the technician that he is. And of course, Julia, because she was so entertaining. But I'll tell you, another person, I really don't watch other people cooking, because there's so many other things I want to watch. And mostly I don't watch, mostly I read. I love, love, love to read. It's my passion. But I used to love watching Ina Garten because I found her so calm.
Soothing.
Yeah, it was like therapy. Even if I never wanted to make the meal, I just loved listening to her.
What's the cuisine that you're most intrigued by these days?
Well, I love Indian and I love Mexican. Can't really pick, actually. I love Middle Eastern also.
All the same for me. I know you're friends with Rick Bayless. I know that. So I imagine you get some inspiration from him.
Oh, talk about another one. He is really fun to watch.
He is.
He is also amazingly calm and just such an A-plus teacher. I got to interview him recently because I write a column for the University of Michigan Alumnus Magazine. And he is also went to U of M. And I thought, wow, he's had one heck of a year as a restaurateur chef owner. And so I interviewed him. And boy, what he went through last year is just incredible. And yet he's not angry. He made it through. He's continuing to make it through. His number one focus is his workers and taking care of them. What a great man.
Yes, I saw where he was doing online classes and the money was going to help pay for the workers. So you got a lot of integrity and strength he has to have to be able to pull that off. Yeah, he's one of my favorites as well. All right, so we talked a little bit about Home Cooking 101, and I think that is a great book for anybody who wants to learn to cook. But let's take one takeaway tip from that book for the home cook. What's the one tip that they should put in their pocket and break out anytime they're cooking?
Don't be afraid of salt. It's very important to use salt, and don't wait till the end. Because if you add salt at the very end, I feel terrible saying this, except my husband basically has lost his hair. It's like a toupee versus real hair. It just doesn't bond the same way. You know, it's like salt. You should season as you go. And if you season as you go, you will use less salt. But it's very important.
So you would say that's probably the biggest mistake that home cooks make, is waiting to the end to try to taste and season instead of seasoning as they go.
And they will add more because the food will not have absorbed it along the way.
So for our weeknight meals, what are two things we could do just to make our weeknight meals better?
Well, you know what I always say, because I think it's very stressful for anybody, you know. Before, first I was a professional chef, and then when I started working at Gourmet Magazine, where I did for 25 years, I was just like anybody else. You know, I'd come home and have to get dinner on the table, and I was exhausted after a long day. So I didn't have time to whip up all this fancy stuff. So I realized quickly that one thing that's important is just take one part of the meal. Let's say you care that night the most about the protein. So focus on that and figure out a sauce or whatever you want to do, and then I've got nothing against frozen vegetables. I got a couple of easy ways to get vegetables on the table quickly. But don't worry about the other elements of the meal. Focus on one part. Or perhaps you want to make a beautiful vegetable dish and then just cook a steak or a piece of fish with some olive oil and squeeze some olive oil and lemon on it. But don't try to do three different things really well. Try to do one really well. And that will make your life easier.
And then stick a salad or something else easy with it.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's a great piece of advice. And I think that most people do become a bit overwhelmed trying to make three very difficult things when one will do. One delicious thing is good.
It's fine.
Yeah, and then get some help on the other ones or just do something. Save those leftovers. Keep the leftovers.
Yes, 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 absolutely. One other thing I would say is that, and this is, goes against all my professional training, but I realized that when I was cooking and I really was in a rush, I found that doing all the prep ahead of time was a waste of time. So for example, let's say you're making a meat sauce with ground beef. What you can do is slowly be heating up the pan to add the oil while you chop the onion, Then you add the onion and soften it while you mince the garlic. Then you add the garlic and soften that. And then you can take the can of tomatoes out and crush them with your hands or in a bowl. But if you did all of that ahead of time, all that prep ahead of time, then you've just wasted 15 extra minutes. So take advantage of cooking time to do the prep. Unless I'm making Chinese food, where everything spends 20 seconds in the pan, I don't do all my prep ahead of time, ever. I just throw all my ingredients on the counter, so they're right there. And then I look at them, I say, okay, what am I going to do first, second, third?
Well, I hear from so many people, you know, mise en place is the most important thing. So for a long time, I did that. But, you know, like you said, there's just, then you're waiting for something to happen and you're standing there and wasting a bit of time. So I think I'm somewhere in the middle of that. But I'll tell you, I do a lot of cheating nowadays. And like, if I'm going to cut up an onion, I might as well cut up two or three and then put it in a Ziploc bag. And then next time I'm going to cook, I just get the chopped onion out.
Good for you. Smart.
That way I don't have to wash the cutting board as many times, right?
Or cry as many times. Yes.
Well, I wear contacts, so I don't cry.
Yeah, I wear onion goggles, which confuse me because they don't have lenses in them because now I wear glasses. Yeah.
Sarah, what's the number one most popular recipe of yours? Which is your recipe that gets the most hits or the most shares or the one that just has legs for days? Which one is that?
I'd say there's two. One of them is white chicken chili, and the other one is braised short ribs of beef.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And of those two, which one's your favorite?
Probably the white chicken chili.
White chicken chili is just good. It's satisfying. Yeah. It's comforting. It's just one of those things that you, once you've had it, you know, it becomes like a staple for you. Tell me all about it real quick.
It's funny. I don't remember all the things that go in it, but I do remember. So it's chicken, ground chicken, and you do end up adding sour cream in the end. And it's got some spice heat to it. It's got some chilies in it. But it's mostly about the garnish. I love garnish. You know, my feeling is, and same goes for soup. As a fellow soup lover, you'll appreciate this. I don't want to just eat the same texture of spoon after spoon after spoon after spoon. I like to have maybe a creamy base with maybe some chunky bits of something in there. And then I love to have garnish with something really crispy, like some kind of chips and some maybe avocado and then some fresh herbs and then maybe a squeeze of lime. So that's part of the reason I really like the white chicken chili. And the thing about the short ribs, my family absolutely adores it, is I am really trying to eat less meat. And so although it's rich and I love the flavor, I do understand that we really have to change our ways and stop eating quite so much meat. And, you know, everything I've told you about that I cook so far has involved meat, which is awful. But that's not completely true. I do a fair amount of vegetable cooking.
Right. Do you put the avocado in your chicken chili as that a garnish? Is that something?
Just a garnish.
Yeah.
Just a garnish.
I think that sounds delicious.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and radishes. Oh, radishes are another good one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they, you know, they've got that heat and crunch.
Yeah,
double whammy.
Love those. And pickle radishes, even better.
Oh, how do you pickle your radishes?
Oh, the same old thing that, you know, just a pickling liquid and pour it over. But yeah, same old thing, sugar and vinegar, you know, some spices. Sarah, I just want to say thank you for helping us be better cooks all these years, for teaching us, for patiently guiding us through the world of food. I want to thank you for all your expertise today that you've shared with us here on Homemade. You are an important tool for all of the home cooks out there. So I want to say goodbye, but thank you so much for being with us here today on Homemade.
Thank you, Marty. Thanks for having me on.
Be sure to visit sarahmolton.com for recipes, videos, and the PBS station near you airing her great show, Sarah's Weeknight Meals. You can find her most recent cookbook, Home Cooking 101, How to Make Everything Taste Better, in stores or online. And if you missed it, you can hear more stories from Sarah about her time working with Julia Child on our special Julia episode of Homemade. Next week on Homemade, Dr. Barbecue himself, Ray Lampe, joins me for a little barbecue and a special call-in program where Ray tackles your burning questions on everything from burgers to briquettes.
I learned how to cook in high school, and a friend of mine signed us up for a barbecue rib cooking contest in downtown Chicago. And I didn't really know much about barbecue. I literally had to borrow a Weber kettle from a friend of mine. And I went and bought some ribs. I found a barbecue sauce recipe that actually evolved into what I still make to this day. It was a 30-year evolution. But we went down there and we didn't win anything. But I really liked to cook. I was a 25-year-old guy. I also liked to drink beer and build stuff and have fire and big pieces of meat. I was like, oh my gosh, these are my people. And it's been my life's obsession, coming up on 39 years now.
If you want to take your grilling to the next level, you want to tune in for the doctor's tips and techniques. You won't want to miss it. Be sure to follow Homemade on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. And please, I'd love your feedback. If you could, rate this podcast and leave a review. I'd really appreciate it. And don't forget, you can find thousands of recipes, meal ideas, and cooking how-tos from the world's largest community of cooks at allrecipes.com. This podcast was recorded in Birmingham, edited in Atlanta, and produced by All Recipes with digital content director Jason Burnett. Thanks to our Pod People production team, Rachel King, Matt Sapp, Danielle Roth, Jim Hankey, Maya Croft, and Erica Wong. I'm Marty Duncan, and this is Homemade.